Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry and put that pools in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know, you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And mess around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I ain't had nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing. But he spoke to me, and however he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit, so I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone, and I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called, and I punched in the code, and he said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this is it. I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, I wanted to be on TV. I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday. And I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back.
Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It said, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This was a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the 150. Club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I called Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on a plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in a dressing room on the 6th floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, man. I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the 6th floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there, another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduced myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I done had this 4 pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie, then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass, then he went back to them jokes, and they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps, and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This is Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was,
they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened.
The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just say, Lord, Lord, Lord.
And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I'd never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn-back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida, I make $300. Then I go to New York, I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
Welcome to Camp Hugue. Hugue.
This 11-year-old spent her summer turning the inside of this camper from this to this.
I was looking through an American Girl magazine, and I saw a camper for $650 for an American Girl, and it was a very nice camper. My dad said that was really expensive for us, so he said that we could get a real camper for that amount of money. So then I went out and I started looking for one. We saw down the road a house had a camper for sale that I had been looking at for a while. So I really wanted to get it, and the guy said it was for $500. And then I told him $400 because that was what I had. And he said sold.
And the total cost of renovations thus far? $400.
We had looked on Pinterest and saw a lot of cool camper ideas, and I liked this beachy boho style with lots of plants and different colors and sea glass and driftwood, that style. So I liked that, and we decided to paint the camper walls white and then our kitchen cabinet turquoise. So this is my dining area. I got this from our potting shed that had dust and dead flies all over it, so we cleaned it up, and that's what we got. we planted some plants from Dollar General in there. We have all of this on the backside came from our house except for that one picture back there from Dollar General. And a fun fact about these, this table and these cabinets, they flip down into a bed, and so does this. And then over here we have the kitchen where we can't quite cook stuff yet, but it's very decorative. And this is our refrigerator, to fit inside of it. And then if we walk a little further down, we have right here, these are very nice decals that we got for a dollar at the Dollar Tree. And then if we walk a little bit farther in here, we have a mirror that we painted the edges that came with the camper originally. And we have a closet over here, and it says Lauren's Little Camper. I got this sign from my neighbor who made it for me. And then we keep walking, and now we're in the bedroom. So we have four beds in here, and we got these really cute mattresses off of Etsy.
She painted most of it herself. She had her grandma come over the one day and help with the cupboards, but I would be gone for the day, and I'd come home, and she'd say, like, you could tell, and I'd say, how long were you in here? And she's like, oh, I painted about 4 hours straight.
Well, I'm very creative and artistic, so I love to paint and draw and stuff like that. So it kind of came to me naturally.
With this COVID thing, it's kind of interrupting her fun that she wants to have in it. But she's making the best of it.
Lauren hopes to be able to have friends over soon, but a chance to get away from home works for now.
I hope you enjoyed my camper tour. Thanks for stopping by.
This is Inside Edition Digital.
Also tonight, the incredible transformation and the Buffalo Strong spirit that made it all happen. 7 Eyewitness News reporter Taylor Epps shows us how a young lady has completed her very own renovation project.
11-year-old Lauren Nelson had big plans for her summer.
I thought it was going to be pretty fun, but with COVID going on, it was going to be not as fun as it could be.
But things changed one day when she was flipping through an American Girl doll magazine at her home in Attica.
And she showed us a $650 VW bus. My husband was like, that's ridiculous. You could buy your own camper for that price.
So she did just that. Lauren saved some money and started looking. A neighbor just down the road had this 20-foot camper that caught her eye.
And then the one day, up popped a for sale sign, and she squealed the whole way home,
and she started negotiating.
It wasn't very hard. He said $500, and I said $400 because that was the money that I had in my bank account, and he said sold.
Then it was time to renovate.
It was a process. We brought home a family of mice. And so there was a lot of deep cleaning,
but that didn't stop her.
I was very motivated because I really wanted a place where I could just, like, hang out like my own house.
The whole renovation process took Lauren about 2 months, and with the help of family and friends, she was able to turn this into this.
It's called Camp Hygge. It means very comfortable and safe. It has its own kitchen and bathroom, so it's like a tiny house.
So now you're the owner of a tiny home at 11 years old.
Yes.
The whole project cost her $800.
She has three envelopes that she puts her money in, give, save, and spend. I think she made a really good choice. She now says she's part of the Tiny Home Nation.
She was able to turn her summer around and hopes to inspire others to do the same.
Which is awesome to see that somebody who's 11 years old had her own vision but now is out there and other people are contacting us and they've gone out and bought a camper to do the same thing.
If you're looking to have some big plans in the future, you should go out and do it. Make it happen.
In Attica, Taylor Epps, 7 Eyewitness News.
What's up, everybody? This is Jay, and this video is about, is Tariq worth $2 million? Now, we all know that he's a damn fool, and he deserves what he's getting, but is he worth $2 million? Before we do, let's hit that like button. I need to get 200 likes for this video. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and bang that bell. I'm trying to reach 20K subs by the end of the month. Let's get into it. Now, Tariq, we all know, is a damn fool. He doesn't listen to Ghost or Tasha. And he's been corrupted by Kanan and turned against his father by Kanan and Tasha. And now he thinks that he's a dope boy when all he is a dorm room dope boy. He doesn't know anything about real life situations. And so he tried to get over on Vincent and the Olive Garden dope boy crew. And he bought some baby aspirin and tried to pass it off as being some pills, ecstasy, or whatever the case. And no, that would not work. If anything, he would have been better off trying to cut it. But he's an idiot. He knows nothing about this. He thought because they look similar that Vincent wouldn't know anything. And yeah, maybe with the eye test he wouldn't know, but once they began to sell the merch, then people would complain saying that these were duds, that the strength was weak, it was nothing, and that ruined his business. Not necessarily put him out of business, but made him look bad, as if he was selling duds to people trying to take their money. And Tariq already got his face smashed in the ground like a puppy that pooped on the carpet in their living room. And so that wasn't enough for him to realize that these are not the people that he should be messing with. And he came back talking about he was a man of his word. And then he sold them a bag of bull crap, whereas he would have been better off telling them, hey, I don't have the weight, I wish I had it, whatever the case, but you know, I'm not able to do it, I'm out. But instead he's trying to get money and sell stuff that's not it. And even Vincent pulled out a gun in front of his face and let him know, hey, don't mess with me. And even that wasn't a good enough warning for Tariq not to do it. He's such an idiot. And so now he's in big trouble, and they want $2 million or else they were gonna kill him. And my cousin Vinny, he don't give a rat's ass or a witch's titty how Ghost and Tommy come up with the money. And Tariq, he's such an idiot. He doesn't know that now what he's done has allowed Vincent to put the squeeze like toothpaste on Ghost, Tommy, and Tasha to come up with money to save his life once again. He almost had that happen when he was with Kanan and they was going to kidnap him. And then he had Proctor killed and put Proctor's daughter in a situation where she has no parents. And he think because he took her to cousin Benny's house that he did good. He had his whole apartment where he lived ruined thanks to what he did working with Tommy. He doesn't have any idea on how to think first before he causes actions, because if he did, he wouldn't have went on ahead and tried to pull that move with my cousin Vinny. And now he's sitting there looking stupid, but about to end up biting the bullet because he ended up trying to play and get over the wrong dude. These aren't the dorm room kids that you've been serving. And now the only good thing is that Tommy and Ghost are...
And now an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They want to be empowered to start their own business When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
All right, so today in the federal courts of Washington, D.C., the Cherokee Nation was dealt a huge blow in their fight against the freedmen. Now, for those of you that don't know, freedmen are the descendants of slaves and free black people that were living on Cherokee land in 1866. And in 2007, the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, this is a western band of Cherokee, by the way, Osceo, for those of you in Cherokee Nation, they voted to, I guess that I'm used to saying disenroll. So they chose to disenroll or to take the citizenship of 3,000 descendants of free blacks and former slaves of Cherokee Nation members and take away their citizenship. Now we were fooling. Nope, you didn't read the treaties well enough. You didn't read the treaties word for word, and we're voting to revoke your citizenship. Those freedmen took the Cherokee Nation to court. I'm Comanche, so I keep wanting to say Comanche, but this is Cherokee we're talking about, not my tribe, Cherokee tribe. And so those freedmen sued. Now, to go back and just do a little bit of history on the Cherokee belonged to the five civilized tribes. And the five civilized tribes were in the southern region of America. They were the Choctaws, the Creek, the Seminole, the Chickasaws, and the Cherokee. And the reason why they were considered civilized tribes was because they were assimilating into white culture. They owned land. They owned property. They were dressing as white people. They had converted to Christianity. So they were assimilating into white culture. And one of the things that they were assimilated into is the farming styles of the whites, which included slaves. So they were purchasing slaves. And John Ross was one of the biggest slave holders in the Cherokee Nation. And John Ross took the federal government to court when they were trying to remove the five civilized tribes out into Oklahoma. And he won. He took it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he won the ruling that they had the right to their land and their property and able to stay there. And President Andrew Jackson said, good luck enforcing the judgment. You got a judgment in your favor. Good luck enforcing it. I have the military, and you're going to be escorted off of your property. With those tribes going on what is now called the Trail of Tears, were also their slaves. That's something they don't talk about a lot. In fact, I even had a Cherokee person, Eastern Band Cherokee person, and maybe they were talking about the Eastern Band, actually tried to tell me that there weren't Native Americans fighting for the Confederacy, and that, you know, there weren't any Native Americans that owned slaves, when there is so much evidence that they did. And this person claimed to know their history, which is really scary, because they obviously didn't. Now, the Eastern Band Cherokee in North Carolina, they didn't go to Oklahoma. They resisted. They stayed. And so the Oklahoma has, the Cherokee band has broken up into different bands. Those bands were even more divided during the Civil War. Now, during the Civil War, the five civilized tribes broke up. The Choctaw and the Chickasaws were solidly Confederate. The Creek and the Seminole were solidly Union. The Cherokee had internal strife as to which side they were going to go to, and the majority went with Stan Waddy, their chief, one of their chiefs, into the Confederacy, and Stan Waddy actually became a Confederate general. He was actually winning a lot of battles, too. And a minority of the tribe went to the Union. So in 1866, the reason why it took so long to free the slaves of the five civilized tribes, or especially the Chickasaw, Cherokee, and Choctaws, is because these are sovereign nations within the United States. They fall under the executive branch of government, the federal government, and being a sovereign nation, Abraham Lincoln, President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation had no influence at all under these sovereign nations that are the different Indian tribes. So in 1866, there's a treaty that is signed, and one day all of the enslaved people that belonged to Cherokees and Choctaws and Chickasaws were all free. They woke up one morning, had breakfast, and their master said, "You're free. Go pick out a tract of land, go farm it, have a happy life. You have the same rights and privileges as a Cherokee. You're entitled to land. You know, go have a happy life, go live in peace." Some of them, there wasn't a Jim Crow era or a Klan version of any of the freed Indian tribes. It was just one day you were free and you're equal with the same rights and privileges we have. So you can enter into public office, you can be law enforcement, you can vote, you can, you know, be outlaws if you want. I mean, they were equal. It was just one day, okay, you're free, good. And so that's the treaty that the freedmen are citing in their argument, is the Treaty of 1866. The Cherokee Nation, from what I read, is citing the Act of April 26, 1906, which is another treaty which supersedes the 1806 treaty, makes it null and void. And what that treaty says is that as of December 1st, 1905, no person shall be enrolled as a citizen. No person shall be enrolled as a citizen or a freedman. Freedman is what they call the former slaves. So they're differentiating whether or not someone could be enrolled as a free citizen or a freedman of the Choctaw, Chickasaw, Cherokee, Creek, or Seminole nations. So they're differentiating, and this is very important because it's coming down as to whether or not these treaties spelled out the freedmen as citizens of the nation. In Section 3 of the Act of April 26, 1906, it states Cherokee freedmen shall include only such persons as African descent, either free colored, remember I said free black people living on the Cherokee Nation land. So Cherokee freedmen shall include only such persons as African descent, either free colored or slaves of Cherokee citizens and their descendants, whoever actually personally bona fide, who were actually personally bona fide residents of the Cherokee Nation. So residents of the Cherokee Nation, not citizens, residents of the Cherokee Nation, August 11, 1866, or who returned and established residence in the Cherokee Nation on or before February 11, 1867. So in 1906, they're not taking new freedmen or new enrollments as citizens. The only way that I know that you can be enrolled as a citizen in any Native American tribe today is you have to prove blood quantum. You have to have a relative. You have to say, this is, I am a descendant of this person in this tribe, which makes my blood quantum an eighth, a quarter, whatever. And different tribes have different laws or rules as to how much blood quantum you need to be a citizen of that tribe. And August 22nd, 2007, the Cherokee Nation voted to decide who they were going to allow citizenship to and decided that these freedmen did not qualify for citizenship in the tribe, and so they kicked those 3,000 people off of the citizenship. And the Diane Hammonds, the Attorney General for the Cherokee Nation, her argument is if you look at both the 1866 treaty and the 1906 treaty, that nowhere in those treaties does it spell out that freedmen were actually citizens of the Cherokee Nation, only that they had the same rights and privileges. What the difference is, I don't know, maybe it means that they can't vote in, you know, tribal council, vote for the chiefs, but what they're trying to argue is that a tribe in its sovereignty should have the ability to determine who, what the rules are to be a citizen of their tribe. So they're arguing that this violates their sovereignty. And they're pointing to the Dawes rules, telling the freedmen if they want citizenship in the tribe, that they need to find a relative on the Dawes rolls. The freedmen are arguing about the Dawes rolls that when the government went around registering Cherokees on the Dawes rolls, that they looked at the person they were registering and they didn't ask them if they had Cherokee blood. They looked at the person and wrote down whether they were black or Cherokee on the roll. So they're saying that there's not a definitive way to prove blood relation because no one was ever asked what their blood relation was to members in the Cherokee Nation when they were signing up for the Dawes rolls. And so that's their argument. I'm not really sure who's right in this. So I'm presenting the facts. Comment, let me know what you think. I probably do plan to get a lot of hate from those Native American people who want to deny that there were slaves held by tribes and that there were Indian nations that fought for the Confederacy, but it's documented, well-known history. So, you know, you can't refute that, but let me know in the comments what you think. I normally don't do videos on nights that I work because I'm really tired, but this is big news in Indian country because this could also open up other lawsuits to those civilized tribes. And there were not tribes that were innocent in the slave trade. I'm Comanche. We trafficked humans to the Mexicans. So, you know, not every tribe has clean hands. And Claude Anderson is an activist who is trying to get reparations from Native American tribes, because by having citizenship in tribes, you are tax exempt. You get free tuition into college. You get, they're fighting for their 160 acres of land. You know, you can have a casino. So, you know, they want those reparations too. And he's actually calling it reparations from Native tribes. So I'm not sure if he's going after just the five civilized tribes or if he's trying to go after every tribe. But I think that this opens up other tribes to lawsuits. And if I know the Cherokee Nation, they will take this all the way up to the Supreme Court. Whether the Supreme Court will hear it or not is another story. But please, again, let me know what you think. I don't have a position in this. I think if people are living thinking that they're citizens of a nation, you should not rip citizenship from them. But, you know, I don't have an opinion one way or the other, but I think if you have lived your entire life believing that you are a citizen of a nation, I just don't think it should be ripped away from you. But I'm not a member of the Comanche, or I'm sorry, I'm not a member of the Cherokee Nation. So again, comment. Have a good night.
Thank you. Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat. I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively. And you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
One in a million. The history of Madam C.J. Walker and her entrepreneurial legacy. Not even her poor and difficult beginnings stymied Madam Walker's road to greatness. Born December 23, 1867, roughly 2 years after the alleged emancipation of her race, she was an orphan at 7, a wife at 14, a mother at 17, and a widow by 20. The woman who would become known as the first self-made female millionaire and the greatest benefactress of her race was born the daughter of Owen and Minerva Breedlove, poor ex-slaves living on a cotton farm in Louisiana. They named their special little girl Sarah Breedlove. A washerwoman by trade, at the age of 33 in 1900, Sarah began selling a product door to door which she had formulated to remedy her own hair loss. She pinpointed the root of her hair problems, which was the scalp, and created hair care products and a beauty regimen for hair growth and maintenance that focused on the need for a clean and healthy scalp, scalp protection, and scalp stimulation for maximum hair growth. Her first product would eventually be called Madam C.J. Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower, and she boldly and proudly used her own likeness on her jars and her own before and after pictures to demonstrate her product's effectiveness. Per Madam's own words, she abhorred the impression held by some that she claimed to straighten hair. She emphatically stated, "I grow hair," and that there would be no hair-growing business today had I not started it. She described her concept and method of hair growth as beauty culture because she compared growing hair to growing and cultivating garden plants. She then broadened this concept of beauty culture by incorporating the value of cleanliness and professionalism, which emphasized the overall appearance, moral conduct, and character of the black woman. Black women from all over the country began writing letters to Madam Walker, attesting to the benefits of her products. By setting up a special correspondence course of beauty culture in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then a manufacturing facility in Indiana, and later a beauty college in New York City, Madam was able to further establish and promulgate her program of beauty culture, which trained the black female in three areas. First, the black woman was taught the proper presentation of herself. She was to be clean, neat, properly attired, and well-mannered. Second, she was taught how to use Madam's hair care system on customers. And third, she was taught how to sell Madam's hair care products to customers. In so doing, Madam C.J. Walker provided a solution to the root of the black woman's demise. She raised the black woman's self-esteem and confidence about her own beauty and intelligence, and she empowered the black woman economically, thus freeing her from white servitude and male dependency. This accomplishment is even more amazing when put in the context of the time in which these things were done and in the context of Madam's own background. The time, one historian called the nadir, or lowest point in the history of the black race, outside of slavery itself. The blessings of freedom was now marred by the blatant terrorist acts of the Ku Klux Klan and those like-minded individuals working in collusion with them. The harsh reality faced by the vast majority of blacks living in this era was that the number of lynchings peaked during the early 1900s, as did other backlashes sparked by Reconstruction, such as the burning of black churches and schools and the establishment of Jim Crow laws. During this dark period, most black women were either sharecroppers or washerwomen and house servants for whites. Madam Walker was no exception, but she was, however, exceptional. Madam Walker moved her ever-expanding special correspondence course business, founded on her system of beauty culture, to Indianapolis, Indiana, on February 19, 1910. She then purchased and paid for her home, adjoining which was a factory and laboratory, located at 640 North West Street. She endeared herself to the citizens of Indianapolis when she contributed $1,000 to the establishment of the Senate Avenue YMCA. It is reported that she was the only woman to make such a donation. Madam herself, when referring to the YMCA donation, had this to say, quote, "In referring to that $1,000 gift, I don't want you to lay so much stress on it, and do not say that I am the only one. You might say that I was the first and caused others to awaken to the sense of their duty in helping deserving causes for the benefit of the race." End quote. Not long after her move to Indianapolis, Madam Walker also became a member of Bethel AME Church, one of the oldest and most influential churches in the black community, to which Madam Walker contributed generously. In less than 2 years after moving to Indianapolis, on September 2, 1911, Madam C.J. Walker petitioned the Indiana Secretary of State to become incorporated, and on September 19, 1911, exactly 1 year and 7 months since her arrival in Indianapolis, the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company of Indiana Incorporated was established, Madam Walker naming herself president and owner of all 1,000 shares of stock. A relentless worker and ingenious marketer and saleswoman, Madam Walker had thought to place her system of hair care products in black colleges all across the United States. She also regularly advertised in black newspapers, and she eventually placed her products in drugstores. As she traveled throughout the country, she wrote letters to her general manager in order to instruct him on how best to run her factory in her absence and how to implement all of her new ideas. However, the Madam Walker agents, Madam's recruited sales force, were her biggest asset. Madam held public meetings in churches, rented lodge halls and other such facilities and put on demonstrations, including a slide presentation, in order to recruit black women to become Walker agents. Madam Walker taught and trained them in the methods of application and proper use of her hair oils and vegetable shampoo. Eventually, Madam organized a national convention for her Walker agents, giving away prizes and other incentives to motivate and energize her ever-growing troops of Walker agents. Sales generated from Madam Walker's manufacturing company and the hair care products it produced enabled Madam to give birth to yet another legacy, as Madam became known as the greatest benefactress of her race. Through monies earned and derived from Madam's work in the hair-growing business, Madam Walker regularly donated large sums of money to charity and to individuals of her race who were in need. In fact, Madam was so self-sacrificing and freely giving that those closest to her were worried that she would become financially ruined. Desiring all blacks to have decent homes, at times, Madam would assume mortgages of blacks who were financially strapped, allowing them to repay when and how they could. Various schools for blacks and certain social and civic organizations dedicated to the betterment of the black race were also beneficiaries of Madam's philanthropy. Though many have called Madam extravagant, her generosity and passion for her people were Madam's only extravagances. She gave not for self-aggrandizement, but rather to inspire other wealthy blacks to give likewise. Moreover, Madam's giving went well beyond monetary donations. She lent her name and time to worthy causes. She traversed the country, speaking against lynchings, and fought vehemently for the fair treatment of black soldiers who had served in America's military during World War I. Madam C.J. Walker was an ambassador of sorts, a spokesperson for all black-skinned people, a revolutionary, visionary, missionary force. It should therefore be quite obvious that Madam Walker's passing on May 25, 1919, was a tremendous loss to the black race. At that time, Madam had recruited over 25,000 black women from the United States, Central America, and the Caribbean as door-to-door beauty culturists and was well on her way to Africa. Her net worth was over $1 million, making her the first female, regardless of color, to become a self-made millionaire. She is one of the most successful black entrepreneurs of all time, and one of the first to utilize the method known today as direct sales marketing to distribute her products. She had also managed to build a 32-room mansion in Irvington, New York, called Villa Loaro, which she had desired to be left as a monument to her name and as an example to her race of what hard work and black support of black enterprises could achieve. After Madam's 1919 passing, her hair care manufacturing corporation was used as collateral to secure the finances needed to build what is today known as the Madam Walker Theater Building. Completed in late 1927, the Walker Building Beauty Salon continues to operate there and continues to sell Madam C.J. Walker's original hair care products. Years later, in 1982, the trustees of Madam Walker's trust would deposit a large portion of Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company's business records, historical documents, pictures, and memorabilia with the Indiana Historical Society, who took on the task of painstakingly organizing and preserving the Madam Walker legacy. 74 years after the incorporation of the Madam Walker Company in 1985, the 1,000 shares of capital stock of Madam's corporation were sold to a man named Raymond L. Randolph, making him the first person since Madam Walker herself to own all 1,000 shares of stock in the original Madam Walker Company. A graduate of Attucks High School, Mr. Randolph had never dreamed that he would become the owner and caretaker of this phenomenal legacy. In honor of Madam C.J. Walker, Mr. Randolph placed Madam Walker's image back on the jars of her original hair care products with the words, since 1911 placed underneath it. Doing business today as Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises Incorporated, the hair care company founded by Madam C.J. Walker continues to manufacture and sell her original quality products, ensuring that the legacy of this remarkable woman never dies. The Madam Walker Agent Program has been reinstituted and is the main method by which her products are distributed today. On September 24, 2011, Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises sponsored a centennial celebratory walk called Tracing the Footsteps of a Legacy. This event marked the 100th year since the pivotal point in her entrepreneurial legacy when Madam Walker incorporated her manufacturing company, the Madam C.J. Walker business family, which includes the Madam Walker agents, will continue to keep Madam Walker's spirit alive and well by ensuring that her labor of love, her manufacturing business, continues operating according to the entrepreneurial blueprint she left behind and which is detailed in the historical documents of the company. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah Breedlove. You are indeed one in a million.
All right, I just wanted the holiday weekend kind of slow here today. I don't know about where you are. The person that I would say Sarah Breedlove modeled herself after, at least this business-wise, was her mentor, and that person was Annie Malone. And of course, there's a Wikipedia article on what Annie Malone. One of the things I like about Annie Malone, matter of fact, I'm going to see if I can find it right now. Annie Malone had an extensive product line, which I think a lot of successful businesses, and it depends on your business, you know, some have an extensive product line. Of course, a lot of people start with a product and then build from there. Then some people just have a short little product line. It could be four or five products. Some people like if you go to a Chinese food restaurant, you know, or any restaurant, typically a food establishment has several products that they can sell you. You know, like McDonald's, you got a hamburger, you got a cheeseburger, you got a Big Mac. There's a double cheeseburger. There's a quarter pounder. There's a chicken sandwich. So, you know, they're not relying on one particular thing to make the business go. So, Annie Malone, I want to do probably a more extensive thing on her. We've featured her before, but I want to really get into her product line. If any of you guys out there listening right now know anything about it, feel free to call in 619-768-2945 and we can get educated on it. Man, the first day of summer. It just feels like where I'm at least, a lazy summer day. So, and I stayed up all night last night. Didn't binge watch Netflix, anything like that. But I basically spent the night on Duolingo learning Spanish. I stayed the whole night. I t- took a little snack break for about 10, 15 minutes, then was back at it until the sun came up this morning. Matter of fact, I can read a lot more than I can actually speak. In any event, if anybody has a trending topic, want to talk about Annie Malone or Annie Malone's product line, 619-768-2945. Other than that, we'll just give you some background banter, you know, because you might be getting ready to barbecue something today or getting ready for guests.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components. Not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. Hu's supplier is only a bike ride away.
3000个，赶快送过来。好，这边没有了，已经没有了。是。
But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
因为现在市场已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的。七点钟准时安排送量。对。
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year. But Yupa wants more.
In rural Swaziland, communities without electricity now have the means to preserve vaccines and medicines that were previously unavailable to them. VOA's Caroline Turner has more.
A refrigerator powered directly from a solar panel means drugs and even HIV testing kits can now be stored at the correct temperature in Swaziland villages without reliable electricity. The solar fridge is making an immediate impact in the country with the world's highest rate of HIV infection. The fridge was developed as part of the Solar Chill Initiative, an international campaign which helps deliver vaccines and refrigeration to parts of the world without reliable electricity. A group called the Fridge Factory in Swaziland developed a simple and environmentally friendly way of running a solar-powered refrigerator without using a storage battery. The system uses solar power to make ice while the sun shines, which then keeps the fridge cool overnight. Freezing water packs have the added advantage of being easy to maintain, according to Roy Singh, the company's technical director.
If you have a problem with water or if there is a breakage in one of the packs, we just go to the nearest river, fill it up and carry on.
The Fridge Factory solar refrigerators are now in use in some of Swaziland's most remote rural communities where electricity is unreliable. Nationally, 30% of the population of Swaziland is HIV positive, but in Nasoko, the number is 80%. Dr. Wisdom Chivia says the solar refrigerator means he can now keep HIV testing kits at his clinic in southern Swaziland where they are most needed.
If we don't have a proper storage of those drugs and vaccines, we cannot keep them. So they couldn't receive them and we were referring them to go to other areas. But now because we have this refrigerator, we are keeping those things, then it's reliable.
The Fridge Factory does not use the chlorofluorocarbons that are known to deplete the ozone. It's converted its entire production to use environmentally friendly hydrocarbons instead. The company says the market for their fridge is growing fast as people realize the benefits. Carolyn Turner, VOA News.
You know what? I had my mic off. I was going through a rant. Okay, wait a minute. Thank you for Pianki for calling me. I was going through a rant and I didn't know my mic was off. Okay, so thank you, Pianki, for calling me on that. I just went through a whole rant on the Texas shootings, saying basically small, you know, a lot of people are coming down on the local police in Uvalde, Texas. But look, small towns, Uvalde's only got 15, 16,000 people. Small towns are not equipped to handle big city happenings. And what happened to them was something that a big city like a New York City can handle. They're equipped to handle that. Uvalde, this was a first-time thing. So, anyway, so much for that rant, Pianchi. Well, he might not be listening now. In any event, so if you guys got any trending topics, okay, hold it. We can talk about that this day. We got some time left. Let me see. Didn't know my mic was off. Mic was off. Okay. All right. Okay. So the trending topics, anything you guys want to talk about, I'm not going to repeat all of my rant because that was a long rant. Okay. Let me see. What do they have here? In the news, reports of multiple vehicles crashing into a crowd in Nebraska. Nancy Pelosi's husband was arrested late Saturday night. Six shot in Chattanooga, Tennessee, near the city's waterfront. These are just trending topics. These U.S. states will be basically empty by 2023. That's got my attention because I'm a geography buff. All right, let's see. With 50 states in the nation, it's hard to choose which ones to settle down in. One thing for certain, though, there are some states Americans no longer want to live in because of the high cost of living in sunny California or the unemployment rate in Mississippi. People are flocking out of their native lands to find greener pastures elsewhere in the United States. Survey data polls, resident testimony made it clear which states are less favorable among Americans. All right, Georgia, while it might come as a surprise to see Georgia on the list, there's a reason. People tend to visit Georgia, typically Atlanta, but they don't move there. On the contrary, it seems that people are trying to leave the state when it comes down to what it comes down to is our expenses. So interesting. People are moving out of Georgia. Are they moving out of Georgia, or are they moving out of Atlanta? There's a big distinction there. All right. Let's see, Iowa. I met somebody in Iowa from Iowa. She moved from California to Iowa because the property is cheap in Iowa, and she was a millionaire. She was a working millionaire, though. Okay, so Georgia, Iowa. Man, it gets cold in Iowa, too. Let's see. What's the next step? Rhode Island. No, Rhode Island's small, man. Cost of living. Let's see. Next state. Maine. Now, why are people leaving Maine? Maine's got a lot of all right, I'm just trying to get this to scroll. Okay, residents, especially elderly, account for 59% of the population. Okay, Maine, although, okay, Minnesota, horrible weather. Well, a lot of these places, when people are moving out, that's the time to move in. Okay, so, interesting. Okay, so any topics you want to talk about, Annie Malone, we didn't get deep into it today. We played the clip on Madam C.J. Walker. But Annie Malone was the person that, what do you call it, Madam C.J. Walker? She had an extensive product line. And you know, if you got a business, the more you got, the more you offer to sell, particularly if you got a product, the better off you are. Let's see. Okay, well, I'm trying to see what else is in the news here. Let's see. All right. Okay, I don't see anything else that really like that's piquing my interest. If you guys have anything that's piquing your interest, feel free. We got a few more minutes left here. I think I might get a new laptop. I haven't heard of any Donald Trump's son, one of his sons said something that he really didn't need to say. I'm not even going to repeat it. All right, well, let me see. All right, well, it's the start of the summer season. And for some people, things will start to slow down. All depends on what you're doing. Okay, so, all right, well, it's quiet around here today. I guess nobody has any trending topics they want to talk about. Oh, man. Oh. Anybody familiar with Sha'Carri Richardson? She's in the news. Sha'Carri Richardson's former partner comes forward to admit allegations of abuse. Just a few short weeks ago, track star Sha'Carri Richardson revealed that she was healing from an abusive relationship that she had with another female athlete. And now the former partner has been identified and has come forward to confirm the allegations. 24-year-old Janique Brown, also a track champion hailing from Kingston, Jamaica, went on Instagram for a recent interview where she addressed the situation. And I quote, "I admit I was abusive once that there was a there was physical evidence of, she said, was similarly little or no remorse, and then we moved on. I was trying to move on, and we still got nowhere, Brown continued. Well, that's in the world of track and field. You know what's interesting? I'm looking at a picture of Shikari Richards. She's, what's with black women with the blonde hair? Beyonce's got blonde hair. Well, you know. All right, let me go to my mic. Your mic. 314, thank you for calling. I didn't know. I didn't realize I had my mic on.
Did you fall asleep?
No. I was talking the whole time. I went on a rant, Pearson. You know, the police force in Uvalde, Texas, compared to a larger city. I was ranting about it, and I was saying, you know, you really can't judge a small town police force that's got, what, 15,000 people. You can't, you know. They're just not equipped. So anyway, but I'm glad you called me, because I didn't even know I didn't know my mic was on.
What about this other story I sent you on the email where the lady with a pistol killed a man with a AR-15 semi-automatic rifle when he was getting ready to shoot into a crowd? Where's the news on that?
Well, you're sharing it with us now.
She was just a bystander, and he jumps out of his car because of a beef he had with the event that was going on. He was going to start shooting people, and she killed him.
Well,
identify the problem?
Do you think, with these shootings going, because you know the politicians are going to politicize it. Well, you know what, you got a country with 320 million people. It's something's going to happen all the time. It's the law of averages. I don't think legislation will stop anything. Huh?
How are they going to legislate?
Well, legislation is not the answer, in my opinion.
Give me one example.
Legislation, in my opinion, is not the solution. When you have 300 million people, let's say there were no guns in the country, you would still have violence due
You're
to the large
right.
numbers of people.
You're absolutely right. They come up with all this crazy-ass mess. I get sick and tired of these damn politicians. I wish people of the states where they come from would reel their asses back in and take control. They need to reel in the powers of the federal government, too. Federal government don't have no business having some of the powers that it has in areas where it is present. What is it with black folks that they don't understand that, Billy?
Maybe they missed that damn civics class.
And not only blacks, but everybody else. But let's talk about blacks. And they think that if you got your trash wasn't picked up, or you got a tree don't fell in the alley, that they call the president. Where did they get that notion from?
You do have people like that. Matter of fact, since you brought that up, I'm sure there's a number of people who maybe they had some relative or loved one shot and killed. I'm sure the White House probably gets its fair share of calls just on that. It's a local problem. But some people, when they're not satisfied with local service, I'm going to call the president or I'm going to write the president. Be interesting to find out how much the president gets.
My nephew's niece was killed by her husband here last Monday.
What, domestic? I'm sure they had problems before that, didn't it? Were there any warning signs?
I don't know. I don't know. That's far from me. But he went to the job and killed her. Shot her. Then the police come. He starts shooting at the police. Then he gets in the car and run.
How old was he? Do you know about how old he was?
I think he's in his 40s.
I don't understand people doing something like this.
Then he commits suicide, shoots himself.
Oh, you got, if something's not working, my philosophy is this, if something's not working out between you and whoever, you got 8 billion people on the planet, split up with no violence and start fresh with somebody new. That's my philosophy on it.
Well, these damn politicians want to take advantage, like you said, of this stuff. And, you know, you talk about this school. Well, why did the teacher leave the door propped open?
Oh, are you talking about Uvalde?
Yeah, why did she leave the door propped open?
Why did she prop the door open?
The door's supposed to be locked, closed and locked.
In St. Louis, but in St. Louis, whatever that population is, which I'm sure is over six figures, you've always got 15,000 people. I went to college in Canyon, Texas. Canyon, Texas might have 14,000 people today. It had maybe about that much back when I was in school there. Canyon, Texas, I don't know how it is now. You can leave your car, and I was eyewitness to this, you can leave your car keys in your car in Canyon, Texas, and a car will be sitting there the next day with the keys still in the ignition. Now, it might not be like that today, but it was like that when I was. So what I get from, matter of fact, Taft, Oklahoma, I left, it was kind of, I got a house there where I had to, and I was staying at it, you know, and it was kind of stuffy, so I opened up the front door and left it open all night. Nobody walked in.
Well, that town is down on the border.
Huh?
Isn't that town down on the border? A wide open border?
Not Taft.
I'm talking about the where the shooting occurred.
Oh, Uvalde? Yeah, it's not too far from the border.
Yeah, so if you got illegals crossing the border, they're already criminals. And this shooter was being chased by the police.
Now, hold on, but this
and
guy
he wasn't illegal, though, was he? He was a legal resident of the United States, I believe. He was a criminal. He was running from the police, had a long criminal record. And the teacher saw the crash.
Uh-huh.
Saw him get out the truck, supposedly with the bag, and she props the damn door open.
Now, all right, let me ask you this. Because, you know, this I'm sure they brought this topic up already in this case. Because was this guy, did he have a history of mental illness?
Even if he did, I don't think that would be made public. But, yes, mental illness don't have to apply just in his case.
Right.
What about the schools where the librarians, well, the parents took out them explicit illustrated books that was being let children get a hold of, and the library put them back in? Now, is that not mental illness?
Depends on who you talk to.
Well, I think it's mental illness. She'd been told that the books was, they didn't want the books in the damn library, so she puts them back in so the kids can get a hold of it.
We need to get a definition of a mental illness.
I think I sent you a whole list about 20-some-odd categories of what mental illness is.
All right, hold on, man. I'm going to it now. Mental illness.
Well, I don't know. No, I sent you a list because I had studied that to the point where I made a categorical list of what mental illness is and showed people how it applies.
All right, let me read what I got here. All right, mental illness is are health conditions involving changes in emotions, thinking, and behavior, or a combination of these. Mental illnesses are associated with distress and or problems functioning in social, work, or family activities. There are four types of mental illness. Another one says it's five. All right, no. Anxiety, disorders, personality disorders, psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia, and eating disorders. What are the five signs of mental illness? Here are the five warning signs of mental illness to watch for, especially when you have two or more of these symptoms. Long-lasting sadness or irritability, extremely high or low moods, excessive fear, worry, and anxiety, social withdrawal, dramatic changes in eating or sleeping habits.
Check your email. I just sent you that list again.
Okay. All right. Wait a minute. That's email. Okay. Yeah, here we go. I got it. Okay, mental health, understanding what HIPPA means, sorry, for marriage. The health insurance portability, let's see. All right, mental conditions that would disqualify a person from a gun ownership in certain employments. Number one, Ritalin. Two, brain concussions. Three, felony convictions. Maybe charges, let's see, ADHD, stress, PTSD, clinical depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, dementia, schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive disorder, autism, specific phobias, substance including alcohol, cannabis, and caffeine, confused thinking, prolonged depression, sadness and irritability, feelings of extreme highs and lows, excessive fears and worries and anxieties, 20, social withdrawal, dramatic changes in eating and sleeping habits, strong feelings of anger, strange thoughts and delusions, suicidal thoughts, numerous unexplained physical ailments, substance abuse, to 31 now, changes in ability to manage responsibilities at home and or at school, defiance of authority.
Defiance of authority. Go ahead, keep on.
Now, there's a whole lot with that one, Piyaki, that one alone.
That's like police interactions. Go on, read some more.
And I was thinking the same thing. All right. Truancy, theft, and or vandalism, intense fear, prolonged negative mood, often accompanied by poor appetite or thoughts of death, frequent outbursts of anger, 36, changes in school performance, 37, poor grades despite strong efforts. I don't know about that one. Excessive worry and anxiety. Some of these are repeating itself. Hyperactivity, persistent nightmares, persistent disobedience or aggression.
That's another
frequent
one.
Yeah. See, I'm thinking about a lot of these guys who got shot.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, frequent temper tantrums, thoughts of lingering oppressive victimization.
Oh, wait a minute. Read that again.
And thoughts of lingering oppressive victimization.
Oh, that sounds like constantly talking about slavery.
And PTSD, post-traumatic slave syndrome.
Yes.
You know, I would say that is an illness.
It is an illness. Look at number 55. Sex drive changes.
All right, 55. Yeah, sex drive changes. What the hell is that woman about?
The American Psychiatric Society.
Anything to do with transgender?
Yes, the American Psychiatric Society at one time listed homosexuality as a mental disease.
I did hear about that.
So you got people walking around with mental disease that's unidentified. Hell, damn near everybody's got something wrong with them, I guess.
Well, this list covered a lot.
These folks that's constantly talking about the white man this, white man that, slavery and all this. That's lingering victimization. Thoughts of. That's a mental illness.
I would agree with that.
What else can it be? And you know,
we're talking about people that didn't know any slaves for the most part. They never experienced but they're victims.
Think
they
how contagious
victims.
It is. Think how contagious it is because you will hear a young person that done heard somebody tell them this stuff, and now they use it.
Right. Well, there's a lot of 20-year-olds that are victims. Oh, they feel that.
Yeah, they don't
been
contaminated. Like when you listen to that one guy, what's his name? Fuller. The stuff he be talking about, and Omar Johnson, and one of your callers, that stuff is contagious.
Well, yeah,
they spread.
With Fuller, you got to, I cherry pick his stuff. But he, like the piece I play, which you guys heard on here plenty of times, about the building the shotgun house. The part about that, but I play the content because of people building the shotgun houses. But then at the end of it, which I don't agree with him, when he says, and then came the white supremacists and they took it out of the schools. That, I'm not buying that part of it.
And I agree with you. No one taking jack out of a school. You can have whatever you want to in your schools in the hood. You know, but who's going to stop you? Let me ask you something. Who gonna stop a school in the hood from having what it wants? Then the question is, who's stopping them from having? Who is not stopping them from having what they want? Leave it to them. They say everybody, and I always refer to whites. Ain't no whites been in the hood since Moses left. So who's stopping them from having what they want to teach their kids? Who's stopping them from teaching their children? For what they want to teach them in your churches.
True. And white folks have their own problems.
They got their own problems. They probably similar to the same ones that black-skinned people have also.
They do. They're trying to pay the bills. They're raising children. You know, they got crime in their community. Like Columbine. That was a white community.
Yeah, but they don't have nowhere near the crime.
It's a Mexican community. Yeah.
They don't have nowhere near the crime that black folks. Blacks is unique. And not only in bad things, but good things too. But when it comes down to the crime, nobody having crime in their neighborhood like you find in black society. And not all of it, but in certain segments of it.
Well.
So, in this town, and definitely. And then you got the same mental illness that lies within the media. Think about it. The media has to have a mental illness because they constantly harp on these race issues. And then you got this one, what is it, one black news network or one black news network, BNN. They do it. Have you ever heard them? They usually come on the top of the hour.
YouTube. I know it was somebody that was coming through my YouTube news feed, but they were playing victimhood stuff too much. They don't come through my news feed no more.
Well, yeah, that's what they do. They elaborate on the adjectives they use, white male this, against a black male that. Damn near every, they pull out things that, they pull out information that you just don't readily view when you read the story. So they got it. I think that people that vote for them got a mental illness. This critical race theory advocate, that's a mental illness, because what they're trying to do is teach it to white kids in order to shame them or the guilt trip them. Now, why would they guilt trip them? Well, it's simple. They're trying to get something.
Yeah, well.
They're trying to get something. If somebody, it's just like when you're in classroom, you go looking for your pencil and it's missing, and you look and know that another student got it, all right? And you trying to get it from them. Well, the thing you do resort to is the guilt trip blame. God's going to get you. Your mama's going to whip you. The teacher's going to punish you. That's guilt trip. And sooner or later,
right,
they do what? Give the pencil back, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what these black factions are trying to do to the whites, trying to guilt trip them into giving up something, probably reparations or whatever.
Well, they pulled it off in Evanston. At least, I don't know what, I haven't followed it lately, but because that, in my opinion, was fake reparations. It wasn't based, their legislation's not based on slavery at all.
Well, they ain't going no place with that. How the hell are you going to make something specifically for one, and you in a town, a public environment, you're going to make something specific for one person? That's outright discrimination by a government. That ain't going to go no damn where. Just like O'Connell was talking about compromising with the Democrats on gun regulations. That ain't going to go no damn where. Every time you have one of these incidents, they chip away a little bit and a little bit more from outright taking people's guns or denying them from having them. Ain't nothing wrong with no damn guns. It's people.
Yep. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. Be about gun, knife, whatever, you know. Well, Pianki, I'm going to knock off here. You have a good and safe holiday. Everybody listening, have a good and safe rest of the holiday. See you guys tomorrow.